All right. Well, good evening. My name is Justin, and I am one of the pastors here. I'm super excited to begin a new series with us tonight called Ferocious Faith. We're looking at this story in the book of Daniel, and we're going to be spending the next few months walking through the book of Daniel. And if you're not familiar with the book of Daniel, that's perfectly okay. We hope to catch you up on the narrative tonight. And I remember this week as I was reading one commentary and kind of preparing this week, one commentator said, when you read the book of Daniel, you'll see that there is so much story in this that it compares to something like Star Wars or Lord of the Rings. And immediately I was lost because those aren't the type of movies I watch. And if that's your kind of movie, you're going to love this. But one of the things that it talked about was that we can easily get caught up in the story and tend to just think of this as maybe a narrative or something, and we don't look at it as history, that it's actually these events actually occurred, and there's something to figure out what implications they have for us today. And so I really believe over the next few months as we walk through the book of Daniel that this is going to have a profound impact on our lives, a profound impact on our understanding of who God is and the future hope we've been given in Christ. And so what's interesting about the book of Daniel, I want to start off by just giving us a little background and kind of giving us some understanding of where kind of Daniel falls. What we have here is not just 66 random books that are just all collected, but this book tells of one story. And so I want to help you kind of get into the narrative and figure out where we are in the story, what's happening in this story, what precedes this story. And then what's interesting about the book of Daniel is it tells about future events as well, some events which have already happened that preceded us, and some events that are going to happen at the end of time. And so it's this really cool book in the sense that we're seeing this unfold amongst numerous and many, many different years. Excuse me. So what we find interesting about the book of Daniel, and I'm going to briefly touch on a few things here, and then we're going to jump into them much more deeply than we are in this sermon. But in Daniel chapter 7, verse 13 and 14, it talks about the coming of Messiah. And for Daniel, this was something in the future, something that was a prophecy, something that he saw in a vision, something that he longed to be true. But it says in Daniel 7, 13 to 14, I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like the Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days, and he was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. And what's interesting is Daniel is written in about 600 BC, 600 years before Christ. This prophecy came that there's going to come one day someone who's going to be over all kingdoms and all people, and he's going to have a dominion that will last forever. And so Daniel's writing about this. And then we see that there's other events that describe the end time. So when you go to the end of the book of Daniel, in Daniel chapter 12, verse 1, it says, at that time shall arise Michael, the great prince, who has charge of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble. It's saying that there's going to be this time, it's going to be difficult. There's going to be this time of difficulty and tribulation like we've ever experienced. And it says, such as never has been since there was a nation till that time. But at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone whose name shall be found written in the book. And what I find interesting about Daniel is Daniel is one who has this ferocious faith that we're talking about. This ferocious faith. But yet he knows less of what we know about today. He has fewer knowledge of the things of Christ than what we have today. He had only heard of the coming Messiah. He had only heard about his people being delivered. And we stand on this side with confidence, knowing that some of the things that he has written about has come true. And it not only gives us hope for that, but it also gives us hope for the future things that Daniel's written. In Daniel chapter 12, Daniel says, I heard of these things, I heard of these prophecies, I heard of these things of the coming Messiah and the end times. And he literally says about halfway down in the chapter, Lord, I don't understand these things. I don't have any clue. But yet Daniel is a person of ferocious faith. He says, I don't understand. What shall become the outcome of these things? And the Lord spoke to him and said, go your way, Daniel, for the words are shut up and sealed until the end of time. Now, if we jump into the end of time and we read John's story of the revelation and we go to Revelation chapter 5, we see, and I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals? So here we got Daniel going, hey, everything I just told you, it is sealed until the end time. And then here we have in John, in Revelation, John writing, it says, who's going to undo the seal? Who's going to break the seal? And he says, and no one on heaven and no one on earth is worthy to open it. And he said, I began to weep loudly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll. And one of the elders said, weep no more. Behold, the Lion and tribe of Judah, the root of David, has conquered so he can open the scroll and its seven seals. And that's good news. And this should bolster our faith because we're going to read about Daniel's ferocious faith. And we're going to read about the context and culture in which Daniel grew up in. And if you're here and maybe you're a teenager or maybe you're a kid in the room and you're like, man, what does this story have to do with me? Well, this story has everything to do with you because it's said that Daniel was probably only about 13 to 16 years old. And we're going to see the faith that he had. Many of us would crumble underneath the temptation, crumble underneath the persecution, crumble underneath the circumstances that Daniel was placed in. But Daniel was able to remain faithful. And we read this story, and it may actually move us to a place where we're like, holding up Daniel as the hero of the story. But I want you to make sure that you don't miss the point of Daniel. It's not the strength of your faith, but the object of your faith. See, the point of our series is not to have a faith like Daniel, but to see a victorious God who can support a ferocious faith like Daniel. That's our hope. Is that you would see this victorious God that we sang about, talking about undefeated, that he's victorious. This is what I want you to see, that all throughout the book of Daniel, God is pictured as one who is victorious, one who is trustworthy, one who is worthy of putting our ferocious faith into. And so let's read Daniel chapter 1:1-7. That's going to be the passage we look at tonight, Daniel 1:1-7. And we're going to be walking through this pretty much verse by verse over the next few months. It says this, and I'll just tell you, there's lots of awesome names. And if you've been with us any length of time, you probably know I'm not a Hebrew scholar. So if it comes up with a name and we don't know how to say it, you just say it really fast and you say it with confidence and everyone's like, yeah, that's great. He knows Hebrew. And so that's what I'm going to do. So if you're like, no, that's not actually how you say that, you can teach next week. So in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of nobility, youths without blemish, a good appearance, skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace. And they're going to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. And the king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. And they were to be educated for 3 years. And at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Among these, the people that were chosen were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar. Hananiah he called Shadrach. Mishael he called Meshach. And Azariah he called Abednego. Now, we read in Daniel 1, 1 through 7, it kind of starts off and it gives us the period in which Daniel was written. It tells us in the period of history that King Nebuchadnezzar is king of Babylon, okay? And that he was going to besiege Jerusalem. And so he comes to Jerusalem and thousands of people are held captive. And so this is where we jump into the story. We read about the Jews being in exile. They're taken to a foreign country. And I want to kind of back up and I want to show you why, because it's important, because we have some interesting words used in this passage, because it says God gave. It says God gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. God is giving them control. God is giving Nebuchadnezzar this power. And so what's interesting is when we jump back and we read earlier on in the Old Testament, in the book of Leviticus, we read in Leviticus chapter 26, verse 14, 15, the Lord warned Jerusalem. He warned Jerusalem and he said, if you will not listen to me and you will not do all of these commandments, if you spurn my statutes, if your soul abhors my rules so that you will not do my commandments, but you break my covenant, then I will do this to you. Okay? And this is what he says in Leviticus. We read down in verse 31 of Leviticus 26. And he says, I'm going to lay your cities to waste, and I will make your sanctuaries desolate, and I will not smell your pleasing aromas, and I myself will devastate the land so that your enemies who settle in it shall be appalled at it. And I will scatter you amongst the nations, and I will unsheathe the sword after you, and your land shall be a desolation, and your cities shall be a waste. Verse 40, but if they confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their fathers and their treachery that they committed against me, here's what he said he would do. And so we see the grace that is given. The Lord is saying, but if they, in that meantime, if they acknowledge their iniquity, if they acknowledge their sin, if they acknowledge that they have not followed my commandments, he says, I will remember the covenant that I made with their forefathers who brought out of the land of Egypt in the sight of nations, that I will be their God and I am their Lord. So we are reading about the time when God's people did not obey and God's people were doing what was right in their own eyes. And because of that, they were captured and they were in exile. They were in foreign land. And so it's important to know about Babylon. In Babylon, it was not the culture they were used to. It wasn't they didn't worship the God of the Israelites in Babylon. And so they were taken to this foreign land, and this is where they're going to journey for their days. In Jeremiah chapter 25, we read about this as well. Therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, because you have not obeyed, behold, I will send for all the tribes of the north and for Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and I will bring them against this land and its inhabitants, against all these surrounding nations, and I will devote them to destruction and make them a horror, a hissing, and an everlasting desolation. Moreover, I will banish them from the voice of mirror and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, the grinding of millstones and the light of lamp. This whole land shall become a ruin and a waste, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. We are reading in the book of Daniel about those 70 years. That's where we are in the story. And as they're taken in this place of exile, as they're taken to this foreign country, we read that it is God who is working behind all of this, and it says God gave. In fact, when you read Daniel chapter 1, you're going to see three or four times where it says that God gave. And we're going to see that used, and that may throw us off a little bit, that it's actually the Lord who gives Jerusalem to King Nebuchadnezzar. Right? Like that seems like why would the Lord do that? I thought he was there to protect us. I thought he was there to rescue us. And maybe the very means in which he is using to protect us and to rescue us is to allow us to go outside of the comforts of Jerusalem and be in exile so that we'll recognize our need, so that we'll be moved to a place where we'll sing just what we just sang, Lord, I need you. That he actually moves us to a place that we wouldn't even be moved to that place inside the comforts of Jerusalem. And so the fact that God is giving, the fact that God is over this, the fact that God is all powerful over this is a term we use known as the sovereignty of God. And this is the fact that God is over men and nations and he's working. The Westminster Confession of Faith says, God from all eternity did by the most wise and holy counsel of his own will freely and unchangeably ordain whatever comes to pass. Whatever comes to pass, God is working in the midst. Now, I hope you would hear that and be encouraged, that you would know God to be good no matter what circumstances surround us. I think it's easy for us to look at circumstances of life and we're like, God is absent or God is unaware. But here, God is very much at work and present. In fact, he was the very one who gave over Jerusalem to King Nebuchadnezzar. I think about circumstances in my own life, and many of you know my mom is battling Alzheimer's, and I just look at her journey, and I was looking at pictures the other night, and just 10, 11 years ago, my mom was a different woman. Totally different. And I just think about my mom and I think about how she would want to spend her years of retirement and how she would love to be here gathered with us as the church and how she would have loved to have been serving in our kids' ministry and being a part and serving in our city. And that's not her story. And I can look at that story and I can look at my mom and I'm like, man, God, where are you in the midst of this? And I can confidently say, because of what I know to be true about the Bible, that God is very much aware, that God has allowed the sickness to come upon her, and that God is working for her good and for the good of those around us. We see all throughout the Bible, we can easily look at circumstances, and because circumstances, we can say God is not there. We see that time and time and time again. But it's actually in the midst of that we see that God is very much present. God is good, and we are to trust the goodness of God even when the circumstances are terrible. So the Lord gave. And it tells us what he gave. He gave people, and he gave material goods. And it said that these material goods were brought and placed before the God of Nebuchadnezzar. It was not the God of the Israelites. It's not Yahweh as the God we know. It was the God of Nebuchadnezzar. And so they're in foreign territory, and it's similar to today. One of the many things we're going to be looking at in this book is how does our faith remain? How do we continue to have a ferocious faith in a culture that does not only, it doesn't worship our God, but it ridicules, mocks, and belittles the God that we follow? We live in a culture very similar to Babylon. We're very similar that the God of our culture is not the God of our Bible. The God that is worshiped in our city is not the God of our Bible. And so how do we remain faithful in the midst of that? And what we're going to see in verse 3 and verse 4 of Daniel chapter 1:1-7 is that in this culture, King Nebuchadnezzar is going to bring some, and they're going to be assimilated into the culture. That ideally, that King Nebuchadnezzar wants them to take on the traditions, to take on the practices, to take on the worship of the God of King Nebuchadnezzar. And so he's going to expose them to their teaching. He's going to expose them to their patterns and rhythms of life. And you can only imagine the impact that this would have on you and I. Now imagine the impact that this would have on a teenager. On a teenager. That's the story of Daniel. Imagine how his view of man, how his view of God, how his view of sin, how his view of redemption would be different now that he's sitting under King Nebuchadnezzar's teachers, and he's being infiltrated. And many of us would think of this, and many of us are thinking like we're raising kids in that culture. And that's why we're going to isolate ourselves from culture. And that's one of the things that this book talks about is that it's not about running from culture. We don't see Daniel run from culture. We actually see Daniel influence culture as a young teenager. And that's one of the great stories of how do we have a ferocious faith? How do we believe a God that is victorious, that would really move us to a place where we can stand in a culture that is eroding all around us? Where we stand in a culture that's trying to get us to assimilate, a culture that's trying to get us to blend in, a culture that's trying to get us to bow down to false gods. And what this text is going to teach us is it's going to give us an example of what it looks like to stand in a culture like that. We don't know Daniel's background. We don't know if Daniel had godly mother and a godly father that poured in and invested. We have no idea of the backstory. But we read in the story that this is four young men who not only listen to God, but trust and have faith in God. They have a ferocious, ferocious faith. And that's kind of the idea I see a lot in our culture that we have a faltering faith. It seems the more as we get exposed to more of culture and we get exposed to more of life around us, our faith begins to falter. And what I want to do is I want to encourage us to look at this book and to see that Daniel was faithful amidst the circumstances that he was surrounded in. It's 70 years, just like I read about in Jeremiah. For 70 years, Jeremiah would remain faithful. For 70 years, he would stand firm. He would have a ferocious faith. For 70 years, he would continue to believe in the God of the Israelites. For 70 years, he was placed in a culture that was not like the one that he was raised in. For 70 years, and he remained firm. He must have had a view of God unlike many of us. Like, I just look at this and go, for 70 years. And 70 years later, they're set free. They're set free from this time of exile. So one of the things that we see in Daniel 1:1-7 is we see how the enemy can easily attempt to dismantle a ferocious faith. And the way the enemy attempts to dismantle a ferocious faith is he changes our name. He changes our name. We see in Daniel chapter 1, we see not only are they brought into this culture and are they taught and all these things, and they were to be educated. It says among these were Daniel, Mishael, Azariah, Hananiah, and he gave them names. And we may read past this. Those who haven't jumped into the Hebrew of this text, we read past this and it's like, oh yeah, they changed their names. What's the significance of that? Well, when we read these names, names had an important significance in the life of Israelites. We read God's in the name changing business, right? Like we see God changing names all throughout the Old Testament. And if we look at these names, their original Hebrew names, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, the name Daniel means God is my judge. God is my authority. God is my king. Okay? Hananiah means God has been gracious. God has been gracious. What a great name. Mishael, who can compare to my God? No one. That's his name. Azariah, God has helped. God has provided. God has come. These are the names of the four boys who were chosen to come and be educated by King Nebuchadnezzar. And he changes their names. Daniel's name was changed to Belteshazzar. Hananiah was changed to Shadrach. Mishael was changed to Meshach. Azariah was changed to Abednego. Now, let's look at what their new names mean. Belteshazzar means protect the king. Protect the king. So it moves from this sense that God is authority, God is my judge, that's what Daniel means, to he's an all-powerful king, to a God who needs protecting. It's a change in name. Hananiah was changed to Shadrach. Hananiah meant God has been gracious. Shadrach means I am fearful of God. It moved from God is loving to God should be feared. Mishael was changed to Meshach. Meshach means I am despised and I am humiliated. It moves from a place of confidence. Mishael, who can compare to my God? No one. There's a confidence. To I am despised and humiliated. It goes from confidence to cowardice. Azariah was changed to Abednego. Abednego literally means the servant of Nebo, another god. And so we see Azariah, his original name was God has helped, God is provider, to now he is the slave of a man, no longer a servant of God. Now, we read this, and maybe, again, it doesn't have the significance, but the name you live by shapes the way that you live. The name you live by shapes the way that you live. How many of you grew up with nicknames? And or maybe you played sports in high school, and you had a nickname on the team, and you grew up with these names, and your name was changed, and your coach calls you by the last name, or your family knows you by a nickname. There's something powerful about your name. Maybe some of you think, like, if you ever ask, you know, why was I named what I was named? And maybe some of us have significant stories behind why we were named what we were named, and maybe some of us, it's just like, parents thought that was awesome. You know, like, that's a great name. Maybe there's not that much story. But you name something, and the things are given names because it gives you a sense of ownership. Like, we name our children because they're ours. We've been given authority over them. And because we've been given authority over them and we have ownership, we name them, right? That shows us. Adam was given the responsibility to name the animals. It shows his authority over creation, right? And how many of you have ever named a car? Like, you have a name for your car, right? Like, and because it's like you have ownership, and like you, and so like you're like, this is my car. I get to name something. It was like the first thing. Or maybe you had a dog and you named your dog for the first time. It shows this sense of ownership. And we see that God has written, given us names. And it's important to know our identity of who God calls us to be, because we want to be his son. We want to be his daughter. We want him to have authority. We want him to be our king. And we see that the enemy is always trying to change our name. Let me ask you, what names are you living by right now? What names are playing through your head when you wake up and when you go to bed? What names are identifying you right now? A name is important. I feel like when I was walking through this week and just thinking, like, what in the world, like, what are the names that I feel like, you know, are on me, that the enemy is trying to dismantle a ferocious faith in Justin? What are the things that the enemy is doing in me or trying to tell me? And I think the enemy tries to name me by telling me I'm all alone all the time. If I were to give a name and our identity statement from the enemy to dismantle a ferocious faith in Justin, it's, you're all alone. You're all alone. You know, there's a lot of pastors, like we read, and maybe you were on Facebook this last week, and you see, man, another pastor taking his life. We see it's like in pastoral ministry, like pastors, they sense, and like there's a sense of feeling like you got to do this all alone. And like we should be the first to be like, we're not alone, right? Like we know the story. We read that God gave, so we know we're not alone. But the enemy almost, he tries to pick right where he knows we're weak. And you know what it creates in me when I feel like I'm alone? And I know I'm not alone. I know the truth. I know what God says. And I know I have a church community who loves me and supports me and a family that loves me and supports me. But in dark moments, I'm alone. And it exhausts me. And maybe you feel the same way. When I'm told I'm alone and that's my name, I work myself to death, I live in fear, I try and control everything. And what does it create? It creates exhaustion. The enemy wants to give you a name that stands in direct contrast to the one you've been given by your Father. Let me say that again. The enemy wants to give you a name that stands in direct contrast to the one you've been given by your Father. He's going to tell you you're rejected instead of being accepted. He's going to tell you you're in bondage instead of being redeemed. He's going to tell you you're under the law instead of being covered by grace. He's going to tell you that you are orphaned rather than telling you you've been adopted into a family. And so name means everything. And that's where I really want to bring us to tonight. And see that this ferocious faith, if we're going to have a ferocious faith in the culture that we live in today, then we need to know our name. We need to know who we are. We need to know the truth that the enemy will do everything he can in our culture today to tell us we live by a different name. And so I told you earlier, or Greg told you earlier, if you have your phone, you can open up our Ecclesia app, and I dropped a document in there. And if you go under Sunday Gathering, there's a heading there called Ferocious Faith, I Am. And if you click on that, it's some identity statements. It's some names of who you are and what is true about you in light of how God the Father sees you. And so if you open our app, click on Sunday Gathering, click Ferocious Faith, there is literally 30, 40 plus identity statements that I want to turn your attention to. And I'm going to bring up Garrett as we come to a close this evening. And I want you to spend the next few minutes as a time of response just to begin reading through some of these identity statements and names. And I want you to read through this and go, What do I need to hear? What names, what false names am I living by? What false names are trying to dismantle a ferocious faith? What false names am I making decisions and living out of? Do you really believe that you're a friend of Jesus? Do you really believe that you're a child of God? Do you really believe that Christ was crucified for you and you're no longer a slave to sin? Do you really believe that God is not condemning you? Do you really believe that you're a fellow heir with Christ? Do you really believe that you've been accepted by Christ? And it goes on and on. And I just pray that you would read through these and that you would just highlight maybe a new name, a new identity that you need to begin living into tonight. It's by living in this name. It's by believing these names that we will become more ferocious in our faith, that will give us the opportunity to stand in a culture. And we may look at this and we go, you know, that's not the name I believe. No, I do. Maybe you're here tonight and you say, I am all alone. Maybe you're here tonight and you say, I'm not accepted. I'm not loved. I'm not a child of God. And I want you to know that Christ went to the cross to give you a new name. Christ went to the cross to give you a new identity so that you would no longer live under a false identity. He came to give you a new name. He purchased for you a new name. And so Jesus, who never sinned, Jesus, who lived a perfect life, took our pain, took our punishment, took our sin upon himself, and he went to the cross and he died. His body was broken, his blood was poured out. He sacrificed, he gave his life to give us a new name. And it says, all who believe that, Romans 10, all who believe in that, all who believe that Jesus did what he said he did, you'll be saved, you'll be given a new name. And honestly, I think if you were honest with yourself tonight, maybe you've been living under a false name. We need to trust what Jesus has done for us on the cross. That I'm no longer in my sin, that my sin was nailed to the cross with Jesus. The enemy can no longer tell me that I'm not accepted because I'm accepted because of the work of Jesus on the cross. I'm no longer an orphan because Jesus died on the cross to bring me into a family and I've been adopted. I'm not alone to figure out how to provide for myself because not only did Christ provide, but he provided for the need that no other person could ever meet. He gave me forgiveness. And so what name do you need to hear? What name do you need to hear God the Father speak to you tonight? To say, hey, Justin, you're a child. You're my child. Hey, Justin, you're loved. Hey, Justin, you're accepted. What identity are you living by? Let's pray together. Father, I pray in our time of reflection in the next few moments as we respond and as we read and as we pray and as we come to the communion table, Lord, that you would remind us of our name. And for those who are maybe still living under false names, I pray, God, that you would remind us that you gave us a new name. You're giving us a new name. And that we would step into that tonight. Lord, help us to see the truth. That we would have a ferocious faith in a culture that is out to pour out lies. Help us stand. In Jesus' name, amen.